This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A fan of the annual Hallmark Channel Christmas movies, one local author found herself thinking, hey, I could write one of those. And so she did. We'll talk to her about Miss Christmas, her novella turned Hallmark movie, a little later in the show. But first, while coral reefs only cover about 1% of the ocean floor, they are home to a quarter of all marine life. Besides being beautiful to dive and snorkel around, coral reefs protect our coasts and act as nurseries for both commercial and recreational fisheries. They also provide a critical habitat for other marine animals like sea turtles, dolphins, and sharks, all of which are key species for maintaining healthy, resilient ecosystems. But coral reefs around the world are on the decline. Researchers estimate about a quarter of all reefs globally have been compromised, and about 11% of that number has been completely lost. And that trend is not getting any better. The Florida Reef Tract, which runs 360 miles along the Florida Keys, is the third largest barrier reef in the world. But Florida's coral reefs are disappearing faster than scientists had forecasted because of things like pollution, ocean acidification, and boat impacts. On today's show, we're going to learn about efforts to restore coral reefs by spawning corals in laboratory settings, something that until recently has eluded scientists. I'm joined now from the studios of WUSF in Tampa by Carrie O'Neill. She's the coral nursery manager at the Florida Aquarium in Tampa. She just returned from a trip to London where she spent time learning about a new technique that allows scientists to induce coral reproduction in the lab. Carrie, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
We're also joined by the Florida Museum's communication manager, Caitlin Fusco. Caitlin, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And as always, you can join our conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Carrie O'Neill, first, tell me a little bit about the aquarium and your role there as coral nursery manager.
So the main public aquarium at the Florida Aquarium is located in downtown Tampa, but I actually work at our newly developing Center for Conservation, which is located in Apollo Beach, Florida. It's about half an hour south of our main location in downtown. And the Center for Conservation is a collaborative project between the Florida Aquarium, Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, Tampa Electric Company, and the University of Florida. And this site is entirely dedicated to research, education, and restoration through using aquarium techniques and growing different species so that we can help replenish and enhance populations in the state of Florida.
So your area of focus is with coral.
Yes, correct. So I am the coral nursery manager. And what that really means, a coral nursery can take many different shapes and forms. Very often, coral is grown in an ocean-based setting, similar to a gardening concept where you can fragment a coral and grow a new one and produce more corals to use for coral restoration. That's a typical sort of coral nursery. Our coral nurseries are slightly different in that it's all happening on land in aquariums systems and inside of greenhouses in Apollo Beach. So we do grow several species of corals that are native to the state of Florida, and all of them are listed as threatened in the U.S. Endangered Species Act. So the purpose of our coral nursery is to learn and research these species, but also to produce more corals for restoration projects in Florida.
Okay, so I know I'm not a marine biologist here, but I want to ask I'm totally going to come across as a dumb question.
No way, no dumb questions.
Is a coral an animal or is it a plant type thing?
It's a really good question, and it's fundamentally important, and it's something that people often misunderstand. So corals are actually animals, and although they can't get up and move around, they don't have arms, they're a sessile animal. So they are living animal tissue on top of basically an external skeleton made of calcium carbonate. So it's really just a thin layer of live tissue that's basically on top of a carbonate rock. And the coral forms this rock. It secretes it. And that's what makes a coral reef, is years and years, hundreds and thousands of years of corals secreting this rock skeleton, essentially, beneath the animal tissue. But once that animal tissue is lost, those reefs are no longer formed and just begin to erode and decay over time.
Oh, okay. So you can't just, break one up and then can you break them up apart and then they are okay?
Interestingly, you can. It's unlike a human where you couldn't, say, cut off our finger and grow a new human. A coral is a group of many smaller individual organisms. They're a colony. So as long as you have one individual from that colony, you can break that individual off and it will actually start to reproduce and form a new colony. Now, every individual in that colony is essentially genetically the same. So they're clonal. So you can have a coral that is a large, something you see in the pictures that is large, it might be a few meters tall by a few meters wide, is actually a colony of thousands of individual polyps. So you can actually break a coral into pieces and grow new coral. And that's a traditional fragmentation method to produce more coral. So unlike a human, a coral is a colonial organism. You can produce more simply by breaking it.
Okay, so that then brings me to your trip to London at the Horniman Museum and Garden. So what are they doing that's different from that?
Sure. So corals can also reproduce in a traditional way where a male and female come together and produce an offspring. And this is called coral spawning. So in the wild, this only happens usually once a year where the corals throw their eggs and sperm out into the water column and it's left up to Mother Nature for these things to find each other in the ocean and come together and fertilize an egg and form a swimming little larvae that has to find its way to the ocean floor and find a good place to settle and grow. So that's the traditional wild method of coral spawning. However, what the Horniman Museum has been able to do is induce this process of coral spawning in an aquarium setting, in a laboratory, which is really revolutionary and groundbreaking because unlike humans, again, corals, they only reproduce once a year. The whole process of making their eggs and developing their gametes internally takes a very long time. It takes 6 to 8 months for a coral to produce its eggs. And then they all come out at the same time after the full moon in August in Florida. So what the Horniman Museum has been able to do is reproduce all of those little signals that cause the coral to produce its eggs, produce its sperm, to develop it all over 6 to 9 months, and then actually spawn it similar at the same time as it would naturally in the wild. And that entire cycle has never before been replicated in an artificial setting in an aquarium. And there's so many clues that go into that. It's anywhere from the seasonal temperature change to the seasonal change in the length of daylight to the intensity of daylight. There's a lot of little cues that go into that that corals are sensitive to. And the Horniman Museum has really amazingly been able to use technology to replicate all of those little cues that coral needs to actually spawn in an aquarium.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about that, the full moon part of the equation there, and mm-hmm. I'm like, how do they mimic that difference in gravitational pull and things like that? I mean, that's,
you know, it's interesting because gravitational pull was believed to be part of it, but it actually appears that it is really just the difference in light between a full moon versus a new moon versus a quarter moon. Even though that light seems so low, the corals are actually able to sense just that small change in light in the difference between a full moon and, say, just a half moon or a quarter moon.
Well, what if it's a cloudy day on a full moon? Do they just not do anything that year?
You know, that's not necessarily the case either. So all of these questions are fantastic questions that scientists truly don't understand. So it does happen sometimes when it's cloudy. Sometimes it may put them off for a day or two. But there's potentially other chemical cues that are involved. And it could be that if it's cloudy, they still get a chemical cue from some other organism that also triggers them to release their sperm and eggs. There's so many questions that scientists do not understand about the spawning process because we haven't been able to replicate it in a lab up until this point. So we haven't been able to manipulate it or change it. You can't really manipulate the temperature and of the ocean and the length of daylight that a coral is exposed to until now. So part of this project is really simply going to be learning exactly what cues are important and which ones aren't. By now we have the ability to take cues away or change cues and see what it is that really causes corals to know that it's 10:45 at night, 3 days after the full moon of August, because it's literally that synchronized.
Wow.
And it's just amazing that they're that synchronized. But then I'm wondering, have scientists been looking into how corals reproduce for all that long, or have we just started looking into it now that we've noticed that corals are starting to decline?
We have been studying coral reproduction for decades. People have been going out knowing when these corals are going to spawn. As soon as it was learned that this was a synchronous thing and it happens on a regularly predictable cycle, scientists do go out all over the world on nights that corals are anticipated to spawn, and they collect the egg and sperm bundles and they do fertilization in the lab. It's just extremely limiting because it only happens once a year. Sometimes it doesn't happen and we don't know why. Sometimes you go out and you invest a bunch of time and effort and they don't spawn. And that's extremely disappointing as a scientist.
So have you seen this in person?
I have, yes. I've been working with wild coral spawning for quite a few years. And then just now this past week, I was able to witness it in an aquarium setting. And I can tell you, certainly in some areas of the world, coral spawning is extremely difficult to predict. Some areas are still very predictable. In other areas, even just this past year, researchers were communicating that for some reason they weren't spawning in some areas. And that's extremely concerning because now you've lost the ability for corals to reproduce in the wild, which is extremely frightening. And you lose the ability to gain new genetic diversity by not having corals be able to spawn successfully and recruit successfully in the wild. It's quite alarming.
Yeah, well, when they're actually spawning, there's a short video on the Horniman Museum and Gardens website, and we have that linked to our website. And it makes the spawning process look pretty magical looking.
It is. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Do you dive down to see this, or how? How
yeah,
do you do
in the wild, normally you would have to dive. So, and it happens at night. So you would have to go out on the boat. You have to dive down to see this. You have to be very prepared with your nets and your only red lights, because regular lights will throw off their cycle because they're sensitive to that. So you sort of have these underwater red flashlights, and it's a sort of creepy setting. And you're down there with your nets, and you don't know it's going to happen until maybe an hour ahead of time. You can actually see the eggs moving up into the mouth of the polyp, and then it's going to happen. So you put the nets on really quickly, and everybody's scrambling underwater, and you can't talk to each other. So try to get the nets on, and it's extremely amazing process to watch. Just knowing that it's taken this coral pretty much the whole year to develop these eggs, and then it's just all over in 20 minutes to half an hour, they just all know it's time to go. It's pretty amazing how it all happens. But the Horniman now can get these amazing videos, and because they know, they have it all timed down. They're just like, okay, 11 o'clock, this species is going to spawn, so let's get it ready. Let's put it in the video tank. And they're able to get even more magical videos in these controlled settings, and some of the images that are coming out of the Horniman are just simply amazing.
Well, yeah, and then you poke around on their website, and it says that the project uses, quote, microprocessor technologies to investigate the influences of the lunar cycle, diurnal changes, seasonal temperature changes, solar irradiation patterns, and nutritional input on gamete, egg and sperm production and release.
It's that simple.
Yes,
right?
Obviously. I mean, I was thinking that. Are you going to be able to reproduce something like this where you're at?
Yeah, that's exactly the plan. So I went to London primarily to put my eyes on these systems, so that over the next couple of months at the Center for Conservation, we're going to be replicating four of these systems. So we're taking exactly the technology and the programming that the Horniman Museum has been able to do, and we're going to build these systems at the Center for Conservation, and will populate the systems with corals that come from the Florida Reef Tract. So the Horniman has been doing this primarily with species from the Pacific. And the corals bred there are not able to go back out to the wild reefs because they've been in this aquarium setting for an extended period of time. And they've been potentially mixed with other things. So at our facility, everything at our facility will originate from the Florida Reef Tract, and we'll put corals from Florida into these systems so that their offspring will be able to then go back out onto the Florida Reef Tract.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's so risky, just the way Mother Nature left it. Like, okay, hopefully everything gets together in the water and then falls to a part of the ocean where it can actually then take root and stay.
It is extremely risky and has very low success rates. Even on a healthy reef, the number of eggs that are successfully fertilized and then actually go on to grow into an adult coral is extremely low. You're talking fractions of a percent. But this situation is becoming even worse now because as our coral reefs are dying off, you can imagine that the mother and the father are becoming farther and farther apart. You may not have two corals that are separate genetic individuals. They may be a mile apart from each other of the same species.
Yeah, that would take a serious wave.
There may have been 50 of them on the same reef 50 years ago, but now there are so few and far between in some areas that even in the wild, we've had to intervene by taking a boat to where one coral is, the male is, and taking a boat to where a female is, and then trying to get them together by boat because it'll just never happen naturally. So the state of natural coral reproduction is extremely grim at the moment because of these effects of distance between individuals. Mm-hmm. But by being able to take 15 or 20 individuals and put them in the same aquarium, put them all right next to each other, and then give them all the cues they need, it just makes that process that much simpler to be able to now produce corals with a wide range of genetic diversity and corals that then have the potential to possibly be resilient to some of the things that are happening in our oceans.
Yeah. If you're just joining the show, I'm joined today by Carrie O'Neill. She's the coral nursery manager at the Florida Aquarium in Tampa. She recently traveled to London to learn from researchers there about a new technique for getting corals to reproduce in the lab, which is a big step forward in terms of coral restoration efforts. You can join our conversation today by calling at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And also be sure to check out WGCUnews.org for a link to the video of the coral reproduction in the water. They just shoot out the eggs and the sperm at the same time, and then a little dance happens in the water, and that's it.
Essentially. So what you see in the video, the little ball basically that's coming out of the mouth of each individual coral polyp, it's a bundle. So inside there is a bundle of eggs and sperm together. Mm-hmm. For this species, every species is a little bit different, but for this type of coral in the videos, they're bundled together. So that's actually a hermaphrodite, that species. So it has eggs and sperm bundled together, and the buoyancy of the egg is what carries that bundle up to the surface. So once it's released from the polyp, it floats gently up to the surface. But in the ocean, where you have much more wave action and currents, those bundles don't drift up quite as perfectly as they do in the video. Mm-hmm. But once they reach the surface of the water, the natural agitation from wave action breaks those bundles apart. And then the eggs are released, the sperm is released, and then everything is floating around at the surface of the ocean in a big soup where everything can mix together. However, in the lab, we collect the bundles and put them into containers where we manually agitate them and cause them to break apart. And then we can take the eggs from one individual and the sperm from another individual and do targeted crosses in the lab setting rather than just having 10, 20, 30 different individuals all mixing together.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a Franken-coral sort of.
Well, it's I like to think of it as an assisted evolution, or a almost like a breeding program, really. You're just trying to choose a coral that maybe you know this one is really tolerant to hot temperatures, and maybe you know the other one tends to not get disease very often, and maybe if you breed those two together, you get the magic coral that is resistant to hot temperatures and resistant to disease. Now, of course, science is never quite that simple, but that's the basic gist of it and what you would hope for.
That's the view from 25,000 feet. So make a case for me. Why is it necessary to do this? What's happening to corals right now? Like, so, the wild ones, why are they declining? What's going on out there?
Especially in the state of Florida, in the past couple years, it's been a really staggering decline in coral populations, primarily due to diseases. We have a disease called white plague that over the past 2 or 3 years has wiped out corals in up to 90% in some areas in the northern portions of the Florida Reef Tract. There's areas in the lower portions of the Florida Reef Tract, like the Lower Keys and the Dry Tortugas, where there are still very healthy reefs, but this disease is spreading down southwards through Florida, and it's quite staggering how quickly it can wipe out entire reefs. And so just compounding that factor is of course our hotter summers that are occurring, more coral bleaching, and Florida is unique in that it's a very developed area in very close proximity to coral reefs. So we of course have issues with coastal runoff and pollution. So there's a whole smattering of things that are affecting corals right now. And as someone who's worked in Florida for quite a few years, I've seen reefs decline in just the past 5 to 10 years. I can't even imagine really how much more will happen in the next 5 to 10 years. So it really is, it's an immediate need. It's an immediate situation. The reefs aren't gone. You know, I hear some people that think that they're already all dead, but they're not dead. They're still out there. There's still healthy reefs out there, and we still have time to do something about it. But the time is now to start at least trying these more proactive, maybe somewhat more risky moves to try to do something about saving our reefs before they're gone.
How do the artificial reefs factor into this? Do they help?
Yeah, so artificial reefs generally are a structure. So when you hear about artificial reefs, this is usually a boulder reef or a sunken vessel, something that gives a three-dimensional structure on the seafloor. And that's equally important because fish and other things that sort of depend on this habitat needs somewhere to hide. And artificial reefs are great for attracting fish, for sure. They definitely work for that. But what they often don't do is attract all these other minute organisms that build up an entire ecosystem other than just a few certain fish species.
Is there any hope for these little baby coral buds that are being created in labs, that are being able to be produced in labs? Is there any possibility of putting those guys on one of these artificial reefs to kind of start stimulating that?
Yeah, for sure. So all of the corals that we'll be producing eventually will have to have a home in the ocean. We can't keep them all at the Center for Conservation. We're hoping to produce hundreds of thousands of them eventually. So we will start to look at what's the best place to put them. And it may be an artificial reef. It may be a reef that currently shows a healthy condition, because we know that they can live and survive there and go on to reproduce themselves. So there's a whole nother step to sort of say, what is the most appropriate place to put these corals? Certainly can be put on artificial reefs. It would depend on the location, of course. And it... Yeah, it's just another thing to look at, artificial reefs, but they can be put back out onto existing reefs and just the existing framework of dead coral structure that may just need to be reseeded as well.
Yes, have some bones to sit on, right, and then to grow into. How far down the road is something like that?
I'm hoping that it's going to be within the next, I'd say, 2 years. So we hope that these systems will be up and running with corals in them by the middle of 2018. And then you have to actually spawn the corals and raise them. However, we do have corals now at the Center for Conservation that were raised from wild collected egg and sperm that are growing very well. So I could see those potentially going back out into the ocean as soon as a year from now. And then lab spawned corals, I think, potentially 2 years from now could be going back in the ocean.
Yeah. Well, before we end the segment, I want to bring the Florida Museum's communication manager, Caitlin Fusco, on. Tell me a little bit more about what's happening at the aquarium. Are there two locations, I understand? Are they both open to the public?
There are two locations as of right now. Only the public aquarium and Channelside in downtown Tampa is open to the public. We do hope to have our Center for Conservation available for public walkthroughs once it is more complete. It is still in the process of development. So, definitely keep tuned on when we can get the public in there for sure. There will be, like Carrie's been mentioning, coral, but also down there we do have a sea turtle hospital that will be available to the public as well.
Oh, people will love that. Yeah.
Yes.
At the existing aquarium, how big is the aquarium that's open to the public? I haven't been there yet. Can you give me a quick description?
Sure. It is a great aquarium with lots of different animals that you can see. One of our biggest exhibits is a 500,000-gallon exhibit that has corals. It has sand tiger sharks and sea turtles as well. There are lemurs. There are sea turtles and stingrays, seahorses, lots of great animals that you can learn about, different ways that you can learn about the conservation and research that our scientists are doing to protect and preserve our blue planet. And there is a new splash pad outside for kids to kind of splash around in the water. And our very new 4D theater, which is now playing the Polar Express during the holidays. So it's a 3D theater with 4D effects. So for Polar Express, you can feel the snow. You can smell hot chocolate. It's a really fun holiday experience.
Oh, that sounds interesting. So how common are partnerships like this with other aquariums, like the one with the Horniman in London that we're talking about today?
Absolutely. We encourage partnerships with other organizations as well. We're all kind of working together to make a difference. And really, it's about saving the coral reefs. That's what we need to do. And we can really only do that with partners like this partnership with Horniman. They are bringing the technology, and we are bringing the ability to be able to take that technology and place it back into the wild. Mm-hmm. So partnerships are definitely key.
So, Carrie O'Neill, the Coral Nursery Manager, we've been talking with you for the majority of the segment, but I wanted to ask real quick before we let you go, are you planning on heading back to the Horniman again to do any more research over there?
Well, our next step will actually be to have Jamie Craigs from the Horniman Museum come over here to the Center for Conservation in March. And then at some point, I will likely go back over to the Horniman. So Jamie will come over here to sort of help us finalize the construction of the systems and check everything over and make sure we've done everything right and help us program the systems. And then likely I'll be heading back over there at some point next year.
All right. And then before we really say goodbye, I wanted to give you one last opportunity to give us some final thoughts on ways that some of our listeners might be able to help out or be conscientious of the reefs surrounding us.
I think the most important thing that people can do in the state of Florida is just be conscious of your actions in many ways. Be conscious of using single-use plastics. Be conscious of your carbon emissions. Choose to take your bicycle or walk to the store rather than drive your car. It's just the little decisions that we make every day, such as eating locally sourced food and produce and meats, and really just learning about where things are coming from that you use in your daily life and being conscious of your decisions. It's this number one thing you can do for coral reefs, but it's also the number one thing you can do for the planet.
Just reducing that footprint. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I want to thank my guest. Carrie O'Neill is the Coral Nursery Manager at the Florida Aquarium. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
I also want to thank Caitlin Fusco. She's the Florida Museum's Communication Manager. Thanks to you as well, Caitlin.
Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it.
They both joined us from the studios of WUSF Public Radio in Tampa. Coming up, we're talking with a Naples author whose book has been turned into a Hallmark Christmas movie. It's called Miss Christmas. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.